Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Big news! Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is here. It's Black Friday in July. Right now, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Get our lowest prices of the summer for 5 days only. Plus, amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals with fast and free shipping site-wide. So don't wait. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 80% off now through July 28th.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Big news! Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is here. It's Black Friday in July. Right now, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Get our lowest prices of the summer for 5 days only. Plus, amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals with fast and free shipping site-wide. So don't wait. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 80% off now through July 28th.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is here. Right now, score up to 80% off everything home, plus fast and free shipping site-wide. Shop now through July 28th at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
All right, today we're unpacking more in the Karen Reed trial as it's beginning to get started. Retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer, who has taken a clear stance, believing the evidence points towards Karen Reed hitting John O'Keefe with her SUV, is with us. The controversy swirling around investigative integrity, narrative control, complex injuries, and the official narrative maybe less straightforward than it appears. Jennifer, let's start by questioning the investigative baseline, the thing that's going to be a big deal in all this. When you have a lead investigator fired mid-case for misconduct, how is that and how does that typically affect the reliability of the forensic findings themselves when your lead is involved in something that doesn't appear all that great and then ends up losing his job? I know not directly for the case, it was for drinking technically on the job, but I think we all know the real reason eventually why this all went down. What's your thoughts on all that? How is this going to affect round two now that he's not employed?
Well, I think the big difference between round one and two concerning Detective Proctor or Trooper Proctor, is that he is fired. And I think actually that could play better for the prosecution. And let me tell you why. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have been spinning it the other way. It's because they are going to get to come out now, which they weren't able to before, and say, we did a full-on investigation of this man. Mm-hmm. There was no collusion. There was no corruption. There was no planting of evidence. He did nothing wrong that we could find. And they are not allowed to mention the federal investigation, but they'll say that we can find for this investigation that took place for almost a year, except drinking on the job, driving his cruiser when he'd been drinking, and, of course, misappropriate statements regarding Karen Reed. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have that in their pocket, and they're going to be able to say, and listen, we didn't just give him a slap on the wrist. We took this man's career. We completely flushed it. And most people who drink on the job get a second chance at that level. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about the FBI, but at the local level, oftentimes they get to enter a program. They get a second chance. especially if they haven't been in an accident or hurt anyone, which was the case here. And so they're going to say, we not only, he was completely disciplined, so we're not taking it easy on our own. And I think that's going to play to help the prosecution and sort of downplay the allegations that were inferred in the first trial.
I want to ask you about the independent investigation that went on. I mean, you've been citing it a lot. People have been talking about it. This is one where they looked into all this and they said, not the best police work, not the best investigation. I'm just kind of paraphrasing, but they didn't find corruption is basically the long and short of it. Why should the public trust the integrity of the investigation when so many of these elements that they're investigating, how do you investigate it? How do you know that there wasn't or that someone did not plant taillight in that front yard? Just all those little key factors and little things in this that seem a bit off. The Sally Port, all of those things that people look at going, this seems a little bit odd. Now, of course, you can investigate it, but these are events that took place way before this investigation started. How do you get to the bottom of some of those things? Can anybody get to the bottom of some of those things, no matter how in-depth an investigation, when they happened so long ago?
You know, the taillight being planted is absolutely impossible. And I'm going to tell you why, Tony.
Okay, yeah.
When you look at when MSP was on scene, and when you look at where her Lexus was, It was impossible, physically impossible, unless somebody could teleport or have bewitched nose and, you know, twitch it and somehow get a piece from the taillight and run over there and drop it. It's an impossibility time-wise. And it's become kind of like the OJ glove, You know, found if it doesn't fit, it must have quit, right? Oh, if these pieces don't fit, you must have quit. This is the problem. They had a engineer, and I don't know if that was her exact title, but she was specifically in charge of all the pieces that were found at various places in the crime scene to find these little pieces. It was over a dozen pieces. I can't remember the exact number. In fact, I think it was over 20 pieces. And she put it all together and it perfectly fit in the housing. And remember, we also have the dash cam video in the morning of her broken taillight. So it's one of these things, Tony, that it isn't possible, but people took this notion that was truly contrived and tried to make it a reality. In other words, that somebody went to the Sally Port, grabbed pieces and somehow went back there and threw them all in there. It's impossible. We have the video footage of MSP being there. We know they got there at approximately 4 o'clock, as I recall. They were there for hours excavating and doing the best they could in the middle of one of the worst blizzards Canton had seen. It's just not possible.
What about the parking lot? What about the parking lot where it appears she nudges at the very least the other vehicle in there? We saw that in the first trial. We saw the footage. And you do see the wheel move a little bit on the other car. So there is some sort of contact there. Was that enough to break the taillight there versus during the if she hit John O'Keefe that night?
Okay, so a couple of things here. Again, we have the dash cam footage from early in the morning showing her taillight broken. Sorry. I know what you're talking about in the parking lot.
Yeah.
In the driveway.
In the driveway park. Yep.
Yeah. When she pulls out, you're right. But by that point, remember, she herself has already told Jen McCabe and Carrie, oh my gosh, I broke my taillight.
True.
You know, she's already told them all about that. So why did she say that before that very slight bumper tap? Also, in watching that video more times than I can name, the snow on the back of that vehicle that she taps, it doesn't even move. Like, this is not an explosive impact. And if you look where the impact happened, it's on the bumper.
It'll be a bumper,
not
yeah.
tail light housing at all. And again, I think we're going to get the evidence from the Lexus SUV, because now they've gotten much more evidence from the, what I'm kidding around calling the black box, because it's not a plane, mm-hmm. but from the system within that Lexus. And I think we're going to know exactly how fast that impact took place at, as opposed to the 24 miles an hour in reverse, where the prosecution says John was hit.
What sort of new information are we expecting from the Lexus information about the vehicle itself that we didn't have the first round?
Well, I think there is going to be more specific information regarding everything from how fast it was going, the time frame it went that fast, what impact was reached. I think they're also going to discuss exactly what a driver would have been able to see, all those holes that really existed the first go around in terms of talking about the Lexus information. There were so many holes, Tony. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to fill them all in.
Why didn't we have that information the first round?
I think there were multiple issues. From what I recall is that they literally did not have the technical expertise of the person that looked through the information, that the Lexus information was specifically in their wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. Yes, they were an expert and could extract, but not the expertise that we're going to get now that had the ability mm-hmm. to get everything out of the information that was contained in that vehicle. So that's the big difference.
Okay, that makes more sense. Let's get back to the moment of where things would have gone down if Karen Reed hit John O'Keefe. Obviously, we have the broken taillight. That would take quite an impact to have a body hit the taillight and then, you know, shatter it the way it did. That thing was in a lot of pieces. And the argument that a lot of people are making, including obviously the Karen Reed camp, is the physical injuries on John O'Keefe don't seem to match up with a vehicle strike. Can you counter that? And how do you counter that?
Well, a couple of things. I think a lot of people that talk about this have never seen multiple motor vehicle accidents. They're just sort of drawing in their imagination what they see on TV when somebody gets hit with a car and they're thrown, and, you know, how they look and bruising. People who have been to multiple vehicle accidents know that everyone is so different, each one meaning, and how that impact affects the person. I believe it's a huge percentage that people are impacted more dead on than at a glancing blow. Mm-hmm. And I think John O'Keefe was hit in a glancing blow with the majority of the impact hitting that arm. I think there's added complication because I believe he had a glass in his hand. Mm-hmm. How would that have shattered and possibly caused those abrasions? Or was it the plastic polymer that encased the taillight? Remember, that taillight wasn't glass. It's mm-hmm. like a plastic polymer. And then also, how does the cold affect that? Mm-hmm. You know, how really cold it would have been that night. And you know how when things are cold, they're just more fragile,
yeah.
I guess you would call
brittle.
It more easily
yeah.
brittle and,
yeah.
and easy to break. How is that going to impact? And that's why the CW Commonwealth this time, it was so smart to get somebody that this is their bailiwick. They're an engineer. They're well educated. This is what they do for a living. They look at crime scenes. The person that they had be their crime scene reconstructionist was sorely inadequate, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've got a heavy hitter. And I think it's so important. Like, I would have him up at the very top of my order of proof, because mm-hmm. everybody wants to know how in the world that exactly reconstruct this for us. How was he hit? How did he land? Where did he land? Show us.
And that's a big thing for me, too, because I wonder about that. Because, again, just, yes, I know things are more brittle in the cold and all that. I mean, it's just, that's a strong impact. And I don't know where we see the bruising or anything on John's body from that impact. It's a tough one. It really is, because it's, but again, I'm not a crime scene reconstructionist. I'm not a doctor. I'm just speaking from a layman's perspective of, well, this looks a little weird. So I'm very interested to hear about the better accident reconstructionist that can talk in complete sentences in this next trial, which will be lovely. Let's talk about the behavior of Karen Reed a bit. Obviously, someone who's accused of murder, oftentimes you don't hear from them after those charges drop. Only the only person you hear from is typically their attorneys making their statements and such. And obviously, we've heard a lot from them, but Karen's been the most vocal of anybody. You know, just from kind of a behavioral type standpoint, how often do you see that, where you see the prime suspect in the case going out there doing documentaries, saying everything, and actively contradicting herself left and right in so many ways? I've been going through clips all morning from all of her interviews, and it's like, oh, I forgot about that contradiction. There's a lot. What does that say to you? What does that say to you about innocence or guilt when it really looks like somebody is trying to control a narrative, get in front of a narrative, and pitch it one way? And I get it. Her future, her life is basically on the line. So you're going to want to have, you know, somewhat of a control of it. But the way that she goes out there herself and does it, is that normal behavior? Is that common behavior for someone in her position?
I'm going to talk first from a mainstream media standpoint, and mm-hmm. then from my own personal experience as an FBI agent. So I have four words on the mainstream side of it. Lori Vallow Sarah Boone. Same type of women.
Yeah.
The way they, you know, just have diarrhea of the mouth. They want to explain, you know, how they want you to see it. They just try to control everything. It's absolutely them trying to be in charge and in control. And it's serious personality situation, I believe. And all three of them are the same.
Yeah.
As far as from my personal experience, we saw it a lot. And these were with individuals that had these same sort of characteristics, where they think they're smarter, where they think they're can outfool you. Where they think they're so eloquent in their speech and they're so able to convince. This is not rare. Mm-hmm. Usually they get good attorneys. Oftentimes it's too late. But I would say it was about a 50-50 with the big time criminals, that about half of them wanted to convince you that they had done nothing wrong.
Sure. Sure. I completely hear you. I did a big piece on this last week, breaking down, and I obviously I can't diagnose her. No one can diagnose her other than a doctor. But if you're to connect dots and go, what do these traits seem like? It seems like very narcissistic type traits, borderline traits as well. Not saying she is, just saying from my own personal experience of life, living, ex-wife and ex-girlfriends, where it's like, yeah, I can kind of see this a little bit, especially me being a single dad as well. I've seen that sort of behavior where the partner with that, really, you know, they're number one, even above your kids. And it's at least in their mind, they think they should be. And that's very reminiscent of watching Karen Reed, especially her interactions about the kids that he was taking care of. Let's talk about some of the alternate suspect stuff that's going on here. Obviously, we have Colin Albert out, thank goodness. But the judge is still letting in the other two, as this is a possible alternate suspect theory. Obviously, the kid should not be in there, should never have been in there to begin with. But should anyone be in here? Was this a right call on the judge's part for allowing this theory to come in? Now that we know exactly where it came from, the mysterious man who talks with the attorney and then disappears into the night, and then suddenly they go down this road and they think it's, you know, gold.
Right. It's all rumor based and conjecture. There's no facts to support it.
Yeah.
But my understanding is she's going to let it be like the last time, which is where it can organically sort of come out. But there's a big motion on the table right now, Tony, that I have not seen ruled on. And that is whether the defense can put the picture of the arm, John O'Keefe's arm, and sort of intimate that this is a dog or a human, something other than a car that caused these. And that really, this motion ruling is going to be huge because it's going to show whether how far Judge Pannoni is going to let this go. Is she going to let them come out of the door, basically inferring a third party culprit theory? Because other than the vehicle, that's what a third party culprit theory is here, unless you're saying that another vehicle with another person, like a plow, hit him. Right?
Yeah.
So if they're allowed to infer that, Tony, to me, the door is so open throughout the rest of the trial to explain what they inferred at opening statements. So I'm waiting on bated breath to see what her ruling is on this motion from the Commonwealth.
With the dog, again, that's another one that's always kind of got me where, okay, if it's a dog bite, the assumption and the intimation is that Chloe the dog attacked John O'Keefe in the house. I don't really know how we get there, that this dog decides to attack John O'Keefe in the house. I don't know why it wouldn't be more likely. To me, it would be a lot more likely that if he's laying in the front yard, animals come around. And I mean, and you know, drag things around if they're there and they're dying or dead. I don't understand the strength of the argument of, okay, even if it is Chloe's bite marks or any other dog's bite marks, considering there's no dog DNA found on him, which you would think there would be if a dog's biting your arm. In this case, there's not. What's to prove here? Even if we do have the casting of the dog, and that's a hard one to prove also, like, oh yes, this is the exact, you know, incision areas of the canines, with coyotes, with neighborhood dogs, with all sorts of things. Snow blizzard is coming in. A lot of people go let their dogs out right then. Let's get you out before the snow comes in. I think it could be any animal if it is an animal. And how do we get to the point of proving it's an animal, especially when there is no dog DNA on the damn wounds?
Exactly. I was just going to draw the analogy with Colin Albert. Colin Albert couldn't have done the crime that the defense is trying to say he did because he wasn't there. And Judge Pannoni said, okay, enough of this. There's no neighbor dog. There's no coyote. There's nothing other than a feral pig that would have somehow been roaming the streets of Canton, because that's the only DNA that was found was pig DNA, which was likely, I believe, from ham that he would have eaten or pork or ribs or something that he would have eaten at some point when he wore that shirt. So, they can't prove that. I can just see them, Tony, sitting around the defense meeting going, okay, what are we going to say about these marks? Oh, Chloe, 3 months later, was rehomed because of a dog fight she got in with a neighbor dog, and they didn't want to mess with it anymore. They have friends in Vermont. We'll just put them on. And I can relate to this so much because when I was a kid, we had this gigantic shepherd, not German shepherd, like a sheepdog, huge sheepdog named JJ. And JJ was so difficult. Even though he was our pet, he was just ransacked the house. He was just a hot mess. And my parents, much to my chagrin, rehomed him after, you know, several months. So people say, oh, the family pet you don't get rid of. Well, sometimes it is more consternation for parents to have to deal with a pet than if they can find an alternate. We put JJ on a farm. They put, you know, Chloe in Vermont. And so it's just so amazing that they then started extrapolating backwards. If you rehome a dog to a place that's better for them, right? Bigger, Vermont, whatever, that they can Justin that there's not another dog anywhere in the vicinity, that somehow means that dog helped commit murder of a man. It's so ridiculous. But I think they just started spinning.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this one, because this is another one that stands out, I think, to anyone that's kind of on the fence here. It's the cell phones. The seemingly around the same time everybody gets rid of their cell phones. Not like just, hey, let's upgrade and trade them in like most people would, because they are worth money. You don't typically just toss your cell phone in a dumpster. You trade it in, trade it up, get some sort of credit for it, donate it. That's just a weird thing to me. People are literally just getting rid of their phones in trash cans all around the same time in this case. Now, I don't know what the hell that is all about. It certainly looks suspicious, especially also knowing the other stuff that's gone on interdepartment-wise between here and Canton and like Sandra Birchmore territory, where we know there was stuff going on over there. Totally different case. But how do you explain that one? Because it seems like an ironic little moment in time that is just being explained away by the prosecution as just like, well, people get rid of phones, which is true. They do. But the manner in which they were gotten rid of, the timing in which they were gotten rid of just before that they would have had to turn these things over to be looked, it all kind of looks bad, maybe beyond bad. How do you counter that?
Okay. One. What intelligent cover-up is going to involve getting rid of your cell phone devices 9 months later? Help me out with that, mm-hmm. Right? January, this happens, and it's September that they, it's just like, who's going to beat somebody to death and throw them in their front yard?
Mm-hmm.
You know, no, especially seasoned police.
That part is, that right there makes the case at the end of the day. Like that sentence, who's going to beat them up and throw them in their front yard, especially police? Yes, case closed. But onto the cell phone.
Onto the cell phone. What cell phone? You've been involved in this huge cover-up. You mm-hmm. just murdered somebody, threw them in your front yard. Now, you're so brilliant to cover it all up that you got to wait 9 months and finally get rid of your cell phones. There was an order that came out, Tony, and then it was not implemented. Mm-hmm. In other words, it was retracted, right? It was fought. And they said, no, you don't have to turn them over. At which time, both Brian Albert and Higgins, the ATF agent, Brian Higgins, there's a lot of Brians, they got rid of their phones. And you're right. They not only got rid of them, they got rid of their SIMs and they got rid of their phones. So at right around the same time. But the order wasn't in place. I just want everybody to realize that. Mm-hmm. There was an order, and then the order was rescinded, and then they got rid of their phones. Why? This is what I think, and I'm just going to go with my honest review of this.
Mm-hmm.
I think they thought, you know what? This case is still ongoing. What if, you know, the defense asked for our phone, kind of what's happened in a lot of this case where different people that were peripherally involved as witnesses. I could think of one in the blogger's case where her phone was taken and the blogger got to see everything on this woman's phone.
Mm-hmm.
And he has, of course, made a mockery of her. I think they were so worried about, I mean, I've been married forever. I've got kids. I mean, I am the most boring cell phone review other than everything I review for my crime cases, mm-hmm. which they probably think I'm some sort of mass murderer from my reviews. But for these people, I don't know what they had going on. I mean, Higgins was a single guy.
Yeah.
And I know that law enforcement, we all understand that even though you might erase something, it's never really erased. And to me, did they have anything on there that was inappropriate? I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
Proctor.
Yeah.
Look at all the things Proctor said. Just think if, you know, he were in that situation, would he have tossed his phone, right? I mean, a year later, if mm-hmm. it wasn't under an order or something like that, because he's concerned that he's talked about other people like that.
Yeah.
Or you know, inappropriate. And I think likely these two cops had probably inappropriately talked about fiction people. They might have even had, you know, whatever, sex tapes with their wife and are, you know, Higgins with girls. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I could see them saying, I don't trust the government. I don't want my personal crap in the hands of the Commonwealth and the defense team. I'm just getting rid of it. Yeah. That's what I think the mindset was.
And I think that's a reasonable thought. I mean, because, yeah, obviously the phones are used for more than just business and work and what they're doing. There's a lot of stuff that could be on there. I've also, like I said, I also wonder about other cases. I mean, obviously, this isn't the only case that they cover. I do wonder about, you know, were there, you know, evidence photos or things on there that shouldn't have been on there? Were there things that were being passed around of like, hey, look at this, you know, being unprofessional, but also something that you could get in trouble for if someone caught you, or the personal stuff too. Whatever people are doing behind closed doors personally, that getting out there. Yeah, especially when you do have the reality of something like the blogger literally, you know, ripping it apart and doxing people left and right. You'd want to protect yourself, I think, no matter where you are in a case, whether you have anything to hide or not, just the way that could all go. Any surprises you foresee coming here as we get into trial number two?
Well, I think we're going to be surprised with the increase of facts and information from the Commonwealth side. We've kind of touched on it with information from the Lexus, with the addition of experts that team has added, meaning the prosecution team.
Sure.
But I also expect, I keep wondering what we're going to see in regard to the jury. That's, for me, the biggest thing. I want to see what happens. I anticipate some jurors will be dismissed. I anticipate different allegations. I anticipate issues with those jurors. I mean, I believe full well that the blogger is working 24/7 to figure out who these jurors are, likely, and do his deeds. I think that, I don't know if that's a fact, but we know he's done it in the past. Mm-hmm. We've seen it. There's proof of it. I've heard his blogs about it. So I worry about that, people getting to the jurors and what all we're going to see in that vein. So for me, I think some of the testimony will be enhanced. In other words, additions made with all these new witnesses. The other thing is, I'm really looking forward to seeing Brennan, you know, as the defense counsel has been so strong, I would say. I mean, they're dirty, but they sure are strong. You know, they're smart, they're quippy, they understand how to work the crowd and the jurors. I think we're going to see that with Brennan for the first time. We're going to see equal at play prosecutor versus defense attorney. I'm also curious about a motion that I recently saw where Yannetti is asking for the new attorney to be involved in the pro hoc side of things. In other words, concerning Allen and Alessi and Little. And I just keep wondering, is he getting ready to fade off? Or does he just want to divert some responsibility to somebody else about their pro hoc vice? I'm just confused about why that motion went in. So I found that very interesting.
Lots of questions. It's going to be an interesting round two, and it's certainly not going to be the same trial we saw the first time.
Want true crime coverage all day, every day? Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today, and get the latest cases delivered right to your feed.